Sarah Ellington is a legal director in DLA Piper's litigation and regulatory team. She has over 10 years' experience resolving disputes and also advises clients across a number of sectors on risk management and governance issues associated with the developing business and human rights agenda. Daniel D'Ambrosio is an associate in the responsible business team at DLA Piper, where he joined as a dedicated international business and human rights lawyer. He provides advice and training to boards, senior executives and in-house counsel on the legal, commercial, social and reputational risks linked to human rights impacts. In this interview, they begin by discussing the growing interaction between legal teams, sustainability practitioners and others on human rights risks for business.
Dealing with business and human rights issues for businesses requires a cross-functional approach. Now, historically, it's important to think about the rules and standards that were relevant to human rights issues for businesses were mostly voluntary, and it was an area mostly of self-regulation. And inside businesses, the teams or the functions that dealt with these issues was predominantly PR or CSR teams. Now, as rules and standards have developed into various soft law standards and now more recently domestic regulatory standards, we've seen increasing involvement from in-house legal teams as well as risk and compliance teams. This has been challenging because there is an acknowledged lack of understanding on the part of legal teams about human rights risks and opportunities, and so to effectively manage these issues, legal teams need to engage with sustainability or corporate responsibility teams to bring in the right expertise.
Sarah, and what does this mean for lawyers?
So as lawyers, we're always really trying to achieve certainty and to help clients manage their risks. And so perhaps historically this was a bit easier for us because in terms of business and human rights risks and business and human rights laws, there was no specific laws which were geared towards ensuring compliance with business and human rights standards. But instead, it was all coming out of laws which were actually there for other purposes. We're talking about maybe environmental laws or laws relating to licenses for mining or those types of activities. And so when you've got those kind of statutory standards that are written down, it's a lot easier to be able to manage the risk against them. Now I think we're moving into a different era where there's a lot more of these soft law standards which are kind of being pressed from a PR angle, and obviously that's something that businesses really care a lot about these days, and also more of these kind of hard law standards but which are geared towards making businesses more transparent. So whereas in the past, as a lawyer, you might have been able to tell your clients that they should just avoid making any statements at all, keep all their information to themselves. Now we're in a situation where either because of pressure from various groups, NGOs and others, or because of these newer regulations and laws which have been brought in various jurisdictions, you're having to take a more transparent approach. And that really changes the role of the lawyer and makes you have to take a far more nuanced approach and look at the solutions that you can provide, which might reduce the risk for your business, although you know that the risk at some level is always going to be there, whilst at the same time helping to reduce the risk for people. So I think to achieve that, lawyers also have to embed themselves more within the business and within the specific parts of the business which have historically been dealing with business and human rights issues and are continuing to do so, but becoming more prominent.
What are some of the things in-house legal teams should think about?
Well, I think the overarching principle needs to be, as Sarah suggested, engagement with various teams and functions across the business. And in relation to sustainability or CR or responsible business teams, it's useful for legal teams to clearly define what their role is in the CR or sustainability programs, and to ensure they have regular engagement with these teams, whether there's a specific contact person in the CR or the responsible business team, or whether in the legal team there's a specific person with that knowledge and that expertise. They should also be involved in developing corporate responsibility or sustainability strategies and programs. And this is really important because these programs should be aligned with core business objectives. so that responsible business conduct is embedded throughout business activities, its supply chain, and through business relationships. Now, it's not just important from the perspective of managing developing regulatory requirements, but also to ensure that various stakeholders' expectations are met, and that reputational impacts are mitigated. And also, research in the last few years has shown that where corporate responsibility or social responsibility programs are aligned to core business objectives, it enables a business to enhance and protect their trust, or the trust that the other stakeholders have in the business.
As a lawyer in this area, I think that it's not really something that you can easily dip in and dip out of. You really need to understand the context where you're working, and make sure that you've got a whole world view of the issue so that you can effectively spot the risks and look at different ways in which you might be able to intervene in business processes or set up new business processes in order to effectively mitigate the risk.
But as a business lawyer, how can you be expected to deal with human rights issues?
Well, this has been a challenge, specifically in the last few years. A number of commentators, including within the legal profession, have identified that there is a knowledge gap in the profession on business and human rights issues, despite there being an increasing demand for advice and support from clients. So the answer, I think, is to combine corporate, commercial, employment, litigation experience, which are traditional areas of practice of business lawyers, with human rights experience to ensure that human rights risks are addressed in a way that, as Sarah said before, reduces risks to the business but also reduces risks to people. It's important to remember that identifying the human rights risks, which is sort of important first step, can be done really by anyone with access to a computer. You can really identify most of the risks that will come up based on your sector or based on your geography. But to protect the business and develop effective strategies to prevent and mitigate and even remediate impacts that do occur, you need to bring in human rights experience. And it needs to be done in a way that not just manages risks to people, but also navigates the legal, financial, and reputational risks for business, because otherwise nobody wins.
Is that really what you're hearing from clients?
Yeah, it's really starting to be a larger concern for clients. Recently at an international conference, we heard a comment from general counsel of one of our clients saying that our reputation takes a long time to win, but only a short time to lose. Our attitude to respecting human rights is therefore critical. And so identifying and managing involvement in adverse human rights impacts is a key component of managing legal, financial, and reputational risks.
How can lawyers help their clients?
So one of the main ways that lawyers can help their clients is by giving them legal advice around the risks that they face in that area, which means that not only the advice itself, but also the work undertaken in order to be able to give that advice is likely to be covered by legal professional privilege. Now, businesses are, we're seeing, under increasing pressure, not only from the increase in hard laws, but also the kind of soft law pressure from NGOs and other organisations to undertake ever more detailed human rights due diligence. Now, as a company, you may or may not know what kind of things you're going to discover as part of that due diligence. And you want to be in a position to be able to take legal advice on what the potential legal outcomes of the issues identified are without exposing yourself to potentially have to disclose those initial findings during some later litigation or other disputes procedure. And that's where I think lawyers have an added value that they can provide, working, of course, in conjunction with specialists in each of the areas that you need to look at.
So you're emphasising a proactive approach to managing human rights risks?
Yeah, that's right. And as business lawyers, we understand the commercial impact which businesses can feel if they don't properly deal with these issues. And there are a wide range of those issues, ranging from the PR difficulties that they will face if some of these practices come to light, going through to financial issues. And that's obviously not to belittle the impact on the lives of the individuals who are affected by this. In terms of a lot of the reporting obligations and other obligations which are on large multinational corporates, they focus on things like financial implications. And so understanding that this is the regulatory environment which a lot of companies work within, we can see and identify what maybe the worst case scenario for a business might be. Something like being faced with high profile, complex, high value litigation, which can be a real drain for businesses, not only in terms of financially how you might have to pay out a settlement or you might end up paying damages, but also in terms of the internal resource and the strain it puts on that, both dealing with any negative PR outcomes, but also in terms of having to gather evidence, both documentary evidence and witness evidence from people involved at the time, at the same time as them having to carry on with their day jobs. And so being able to understand the scale of those risks to the functioning of a business means that we're able to inform the higher level decision makers, including the boards, about the potential consequences and therefore leverage buy-in to dealing with human rights issues in a proactive and timely way, and if necessary, investing money at the outset to stop these issues occurring later on. But being able to see the balancing exercise between risk and reward in terms of putting in some amount now to put your correct procedures in place and avoiding further issues later on.
And just on the point of litigation, we've also seen recently that these types of high-profile claims against multinationals don't actually bring the benefits that stakeholders or impacted individuals need, and often, you know, awards that you can get from that type of dispute or from litigation really don't satisfy harm that's caused. And so even from the perspective of impacted individuals, to remediate harm that's caused, litigation is not the best way to do that. And so to proactively put in place systems and processes that identify and prevent risks and then deal with remediation in a way that benefits the business and impacted individuals works both for the business and for affected stakeholders.
Sarah, from what you're saying, these developments appear to be occurring against a backdrop of very fast-moving legal and regulatory developments. What are some of the key trends you are talking to your clients about?
So what we're saying is a growth in the number of international and domestic laws and standards which are specifically targeted at influencing corporate behaviour with respect to human rights. We've seen regulatory developments imposing reporting or transparency requirements on businesses to report steps that they're taking to address human rights issues and indeed to discover them to start with. We've seen this in relation to modern slavery and labour exploitation reporting requirements in both the UK and US. And across Europe, and there are also proposals for similar legislation in Australia and Hong Kong on the horizon. A second form of regulation emerging is one which mandates companies to develop and put in place compliance programs to address specific human rights concerns. An example of this is the French vigilance law and also the proposed Dutch child labour law. Finally, we're also seeing trade-based regulations, for example, changes to the Tariff Act in the US, and even commitments by the OECD export credit agencies to screen for serious human rights issues in line with the UN guiding principles.
Just on that first point in relation to transparency and reporting obligations, we're seeing something very interesting happening. Governments are using this type of regulatory tool to influence corporate behaviour with respect to human rights, rather than mandating specific changes through regulation. Now, this is important because it provides businesses with flexibility, which they need as they begin their human rights journey. And it's really important to think about human rights for business, not as a destination. It's not a point that you reach and you tick a number of boxes and you're done. It's a journey. And so this flexibility is really essential at the outset to enable businesses to evolve.
But this type of legislation has been criticized as a toothless tiger because it doesn't contain any hard sanction or penalty. So how can it be effective?
Well, this is why it's interesting, because in my view, there's an implied policy objective which transfers monitoring and enforcement responsibility from the state to other stakeholders, so consumers, investors, and civil society. And this is part of a trend across a number of issue areas where we're seeing a range of different actors, not just the state, involved in norm creation, monitoring, adjudication, and enforcement. And so these regulatory reporting and transparency obligations give stakeholders the information that they need to track the effectiveness of actions taken by companies and to pursue accountability. So we've seen already over the last few years a number of mainstream investors, not just the socially responsible investors, say that they use voluntary human rights benchmarks that assess companies' human rights policies, processes, and performance, like the corporate human rights benchmark, and even regulatory information that's being made available, like statements made under the Modern Slavery Act, when they're screening investments and when they're screening business relationships. We know that consumers monitor and engage with these issues on social media and that it affects their purchasing behavior, and especially consumer-facing businesses are very acutely aware of these responses. And increasingly, civil society is becoming very sophisticated in their advocacy efforts. So while there might not be a hard legal sanction in the legislation, there are very hard financial, reputational, and commercial impacts, and even legal consequences that can emerge. So in my mind, I don't think this regulation is absolutely toothless.
Yes, and that links into the second trend we're observing, which is an increase in litigation against businesses for their involvement or perceived involvement in human rights harm across a corporate group. And as part of that, we're seeing the development of quite a number of what we might call novel claims, using the legal principles in ways which perhaps they hadn't previously been envisaged to be used. So, for example, we've seen a recent case in the US where the equitable principle of unjust enrichment has been used as the basis of a claim against a company who is claimed to have unethical practices and within its supply chain, and the argument is that consumers would not have bought the product had they been aware of these unethical practices. We've also seen claims brought against businesses under advertising laws for alleged misleading advertising. We've seen claims under competition and consumer laws, as well as complicity in international crimes for the most severe form of human rights violations. In some jurisdictions, there also appears to be a trend towards judges being more willing to accept jurisdiction over claims with an international element and being more willing to hear novel points of law as to why that jurisdiction should accept that it can hear a claim where that claim might more readily be associated with another foreign jurisdiction. And this might mean that in the future, we'd see more claims against parent companies and also companies higher up the supply chain, because a lot of the legal principles involved in claims against parent companies are actually of more general application. This doesn't mean, though, that we're seeing more certainty in any of these areas of law or how they will be applied in a human rights context. And that's because most of these cases tend to settle at a fairly early stage. In terms of where we see them reported, it's often at a jurisdictional stage where there's been a challenge to the jurisdiction of the court. But often we don't get a full reasoned judgment on the underlying causes of action because the claims often settle before they reach that stage. but perhaps the high incidence of settlements in this area, especially where the law is perhaps unclear and untested, so it can't be said that the claim will definitely go for or against the businesses, reflects the importance which businesses put on the PR side of these claims and the need to be seen to be doing something publicly, but also an underlying recognition, perhaps in some cases, although this would all be very confidential and behind closed doors, that they wish to be able to provide some form of remedy to the people who claim that their human rights have been violated. And that's why we feel so strongly that businesses can work very proactively in this area to put in place better access to remedy at source, being able to then direct their resources more towards ensuring that human rights violations don't happen or that they're addressed quickly, meaning that these types of claims hopefully won't come about so much in the future.
Again, I think that demonstrates an interesting correlation between what's good for business and what's good for stakeholders, because enabling some effective access to remedy at source or in a local context should bring in local, cultural, social, economic issues in providing remediation. Now, that's not something that you can do when you're perhaps pursuing a claim in another jurisdiction. So when you scratch the surface of this area, you start to see that there's a lot of correlation between what is good for business and what is good for impacted individuals, and that's certainly the basis on which the UN Guiding Principles is built, which, again, when you look at what the Guiding Principles say and the systems and the processes they suggest businesses should put in place, it is, I suppose, to use John Ruggie's phrase, principled pragmatism.